Hi, I'm Mark Webber, and this is Keeping Track.
You're listening to Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix. In this week's episode, Cameron McConville joins the podcast as we review the races leading into the mid-year break. We speak to Peter Windsor to get his report card on the 2012 season so far. And Australia's Daniel Ricciardo explains the fitness required to be an F1 driver. There's all that and more on Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix.
Hello and welcome to Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian Grand Prix. Matt Clayton with you for episode 13 of our show, where we'll take a mid-season look at the state of play in this year's Formula One World Championship. Peter Windsor will join us on the line from London shortly to look at the key storylines to emerge after 10 of 20 races, while later on Daniel Ricciardo will chat to us about the fitness regimen of today's Formula One drivers. For the time being, I mentioned it was our 13th show as we approach our first birthday, but the man sitting next to me is in his first show of Keeping Track, V8 supercar driver, man with more jobs than we could fit probably in this podcast, Cam McConville. Welcome to the podcast.
And exclusive to the podcast for the next little while.
Indeed. Now,
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
No, indeed. Look, for those that don't know, what are you doing these days, within reason? We haven't got 25 minutes here, but how many things are you doing these days and how many things are you doing them for?
Well, the short version, wearing about four hats. So run the HSV Drive Experience, driving standards advisor for Carrera Cup and the GD3 Cup Challenge. Mm-hmm. Race in the Ute Series for Bundy Racing and Enduro Bloke for the Toll HRT.
Enduro so Bloke.
That's it. Part-timer in the V8. So wear about four different hats, keep busy, and avid Formula One fan still, of course.
Now, you have missed out something here. You've had, I was going to say, your first midlife crisis. You might have had others, I don't know. But you've recently just run a marathon. Now, you've got facts and stats, so hit me with them.
Yes, Gold Coast Marathon. I'm just trying to keep up with you, Matt. And 3 hours 40 for my first one, so I was happy with that. Plan was to go under four, mm-hmm. Tick the box, and a bit of fitness pre-enduro, Sandown and Bathurst, not too far away.
And what was the post-marathon splurge? Did you have something saved up?
Massive. Ran through the finish, walked back to the hotel, straight down to Broadbeach, and believe it or not, a double shot latte and raisin toast with Vegemite.
Jeez, you went really hard.
I went hard. I don't know why. It was just one of those silly cravings, followed by pizza, raspberry cordial, all that stuff.
That's what I was hoping. I see you've put a bit of weight back on. There's at least 150 grams in the beard that's going at the moment.
Yeah, that's it. You like that? Just trying. I'm going the Jensen Button look, but I can't pull it off.
Well, it seems to work for him pretty well.
It does work for him. Not for me.
No, well, since we last did a podcast, we've had four Grand Prix. We thought we might go back to Canada in the wee hours of the morning there on the Queen's birthday long weekend. It was the seventh race of the year, and we had a seventh different winner with Lewis Hamilton winning for McLaren, rounding out the podium Romain Grosjean for Lotus, Sergio Perez for Sauber. You would have got pretty good odds on those three for a podium before that race started.
Yeah, and I mean, Lewis clearly would have expected to have won a race prior to that, and that was although he did take the lead in the championship as well. You know, Perez, I'm a big fan of. I think the emerging talent in F1, and of course Daniel Ricciardo is one of them. He and Romain Grosjean, who has bounced back from, you know, having a year out. It was probably not one of the most exciting events because we've had some fantastic overtaking, but Montreal traditionally is quite a low grip surface. It does rubber up, as they call it, over the weekend, but more of a strategy race, I would have thought, than an actual race.
Well, yeah, I think what was interesting there was that Alonso tried to win the race on a one-stop and was really a sitting duck towards the end. But funnily enough, Grosjean and Perez both managed to one-stop and make it work. We've seen how kind the Sauber is on its tyres, but Grosjean in particular was just as quick at the end of the race as he was when he had brand new rubber on. So that Lotus, obviously liked the hot weather, but that Lotus has been a very, very quick car this year.
Yeah, it has. And look, Kimi is clearly speedy as well. We know that. And in fact, probably talk about him a little bit later on, but he, I think, is so good for Formula One, and it's great to see other teams up the front mixing it up. It's massively long overdue, and hopefully some of the ones at the very back start to move forward as well.
Certainly hope so. In that race, pretty low profile for our two Australians. Mark Webber, seventh from fourth on the grid. Another real bogey track. It's Montreal, Monza and Melbourne, the three M's where Mark has never stood on the podium for all the years that he's been in Formula One. He just can't manage to crack it in Montreal. Daniel Ricciardo 14th from 14th on the grid. Fairly lackluster for Dan. So as you said, more a strategic race, and Lewis Hamilton took over the lead of the championship. We then go to Valencia for round 8, and just a fantastic win on home soil for Fernando Alonso for Ferrari. The first driver to win 2 races for the season. Kimi Raikkonen second, and Michael Schumacher back on the podium for the first time in his comeback. It's been a long time between drinks for Michael, but this race was really a race of 2 hard luck stories. Sebastian Vettel, it was much like 2010, qualified on pole, awesome first lap, and was just absolutely belting the rest of the field. There was a safety car, has an alternator issue, stops. Romain Grosjean was probably the next guy to pick the pieces up. He has the same problem for Renault, and Alonso there, as he always seems to be, to sweep up the crumbs.
Yeah, I mean, what a fairy tale. And I think from memory, also his soccer team won that weekend over there in that neck of the woods. So I've actually been to that circuit, the very first one. Mm. Beautiful racetrack. Traditionally, though, doesn't produce exciting racing. It's quite wide. It's smooth. But, I mean, it went right down to the wire. Everyone expected the Red Bull to be quick there. And, you know, Vettel was making a little bit of a borathon of it. But the alternator failure, I mean, very, very rare.
Who would have
expected that? And Alonso, first multiple winner of the season.
I think what made the back end of that race interesting, you had Michael Schumacher, who qualified 12th, Mark Webber, who was 19th, after just one of those Saturdays that seems to happen to Mark at least once a year. DRS doesn't work, KERS doesn't work, brakes don't work, nothing works. But he was in a very, very quick car towards the back end of the race, and him and Schumacher just scything through the pack at the end. It was quite nice to see Michael back on the podium, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Again, I think everyone else as an F1 fan would have thought that's massively overdue, and including himself, I'm sure. With Mark Webber's situation, I sometimes compare Mark to my football team, Richmond. Very rarely does he back up 2 in a row. And that one, I mean, just an absolute shocker. Not sabotage. People are saying, oh, geez, you know, the team's all for Vettel. That's clearly not the case. It's just rotten luck. And, you know, I'd say Red Bull are trying a few different things in that area. And, you know, just didn't work for Mark.
Well, sticking with the Richmond analogy, one good week, one not so good week, we go to Silverstone for round 9, where Mark wins at one of the most prestigious races on the calendar for the second time in 3 years. It was a different race win for Mark, took the lead from Fernando Alonso with 5 laps to go. A lot of Mark's wins, this one was the 9th of his career, have come from when he's qualified up the front and disappeared, just relentless pace. This is the first time he's had to hunt somebody down in the last stint on the harder of the 2 compound tyres for the last stint, and really just gained on Alonso hand over fist. Terrific overtaking move, just a really polished win by a real pro.
Yeah, it was. And I've got a theory on this, that drivers tend to like certain circuits and they do better at them. Now, now clearly the Red Bull was suited. It's a high downforce, it's high speed circuit. It's in Mark's backyard. He's grown up racing F3 and various categories there, even Formula Ford in his early days in the UK. But you know, it's sometimes you go mentally to a track where you've had success, and it's that success that I think spurs you on that little bit extra just to find that. It might only be 2 tenths, because sometimes I think that's where he's behind Vettel in qualifying. It's that traditional 2 tenths to his teammate. You find that extra bit at a track you really like. It just meets your eye for some reason. I think had he caught Schumacher, had he caught Raikkonen, he would have, towards the end of the race, they would have made it a lot harder than Alonso. I was actually quite surprised. There's clearly a mutual respect. He knew he was a sitting duck, but he made it relatively easy for Mark. And Mark went around the outside and was a great finish.
Fernando's very good at playing the long game too. I mean, he's realising you could fight here and lose your front wing and, you know, trundle around, you know, a lot of the laps still to do, and finish 9th, which could be catastrophic for you by the time we get to November. Fernando plays the long game.
And that's I suppose, the actions of a double world champion, a guy who can put championships together. He thinks about the bigger picture, and even in Formula One, not every driver does it that way.
We mentioned Silverstone. One thing it does do, the English summer, and I use that term loosely, it did rain rather a lot, particularly Friday and Saturday. The ever verbose Kimi Raikkonen, when asked to sum up what he thought of Silverstone on Friday, "It was wet," said Kimi. Well, he was right, but not known for his expansion, shall we say, on particular topics.
No, and there's usually a few expletives thrown in there with Kimi. look, he's fantastic for Formula One, and a loss when he was driving on the dirt. But look, I think Mark, wet or dry, I still think he would have been the one to beat there. As I say, just something about that event, and I'm glad that it was dry, because the conditions were atrocious. I mean, in qualifying, you could hear wheel spin in fifth and sixth gear,
yep.
You know, and it was just potentially very dangerous. Such a high-speed track. If you aquaplane and spear off the road, we were going to lose cars and potentially injure drivers.
Well, it's so flat there too, isn't it? No drainage, an old airfield, so the water just tends to sit there. So
good old English summer. Luckily, we race in the summer there.
Well, indeed. Imagine if we'd raced at any other time of year. But so that was round nine. Then rounding us out for the first half of the season, last weekend at Hockenheim in Germany, Fernando Alonso, pretty dominant, leading from pole to win, his third win of the season. It's his 30th career win. He's now one win behind Nigel Mansell for fourth on the all-time list. Ahead of him, you've got Prost, Senna, Schumacher. Pretty esteemed company, isn't it?
It is, and to be honest, I wouldn't have expected that. I mean, probably because he's had a little bit of a lean time, you know, being at McLaren alongside Lewis. So he's got to be, he's the form man of the championship. And we think back to Albert Park, round one, where everyone was saying Ferrari are a no chance this year. Their testing was all over the place, and even Fernando said, oh, sixth will be the best we can expect this weekend. Here he is on top of the World Drivers Championship. He was threatened a little bit late in the race, but I think when Vettel obviously put the pressure on Jensen, Jensen started driving in the mirrors a little bit, and that enabled Fernando to drive away comfortably.
Now, here's my question for you as a driver. Sebastian Vettel finishes second on the road. He gets a 20-second post-race penalty for overtaking Jensen Button on the outside of the circuit. Now, I know you've been on Twitter today. You've had a vent. What are your thoughts on completing an overtaking move outside of the lines of the track, and should he have been penalised?
Well, in my opinion, it depends on whether you were forced to use that bit of road or whether you chose to do that on your own. And being a driving standards advisor for a very different category in Carrera Cup, we had a similar incident in Perth where we actually reversed the finishing order of a race win with Alex Davison and Craig Baird coming onto the front straight, where Alex squeezed Craig, who was on the outside, right off the edge of the track. And in my opinion there, the pass was on. There was overlap, significant overlap, where Sebastian was actually further past Jensen. And Jensen moved over, and he had no choice. It was either bang wheels or... Now, he probably went a little bit too far off the road. He maybe could have kept two wheels on the bitumen. If they deemed that he got an unfair advantage, they really, I think, should have just reversed that order. I don't think Sebastian was in the wrong. I think it was a racing incident. But to actually give him 20-second penalty when they were dicing for second and third, put him back to fifth, for me, is very inconsistent and very strange.
Well, it's a big penalty too when you look at the points that he's lost, A, relative to his teammate, because Mark Webber still sits in front of Sebastian in the World Championship, as we'll discuss in a minute, but also where that matters at the end of the season. At the moment, everyone's really, really trying to pull points back on Alonso with this huge lead that he's got. So those 8 points could be pretty crucial.
On top of the DNF at Valencia, you know, you've got to say that Vettel effectively should be in the lead of the World Drivers' Championship. He's not, which is great, I think, for Formula One, because it's going to make it a great run home.
Now, rounding out the podium behind Alonso, Jenson Button and Kimi Raikkonen at Hockenheim, the interesting story, Lewis Hamilton got a puncture on, I think it was lap two, limped back around, clearly in a very, very fast car, came out from a pit stop on fresh rubber in amongst the leaders and decided he was going to unlap himself. Now, have you been in a situation where you've been on either side of that equation? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I have. I don't like it, to be honest. I think you're out of the motor race. I don't think you're going to gain a lot of positions. You might go from last to second last. Of course, if there's a safety car, potentially you get yourself to the back of the queue. I mean, that's clearly what he was trying to do, but in the categories I've been involved with, and more recently V8 supercars, it's frowned upon. If you're a lap down, you're trying to unlap yourself, you know, the team owners are jumping up and down. Going back to the initial problem for Lewis, I thought at the start there, when there was debris all over the circuit, there should have been a safety car to clear it off. So I think he was very unlucky. I mean, we saw on the pitches, it was right across the corner. So clearly someone was going to be unlucky, and unfortunately it was one of our world champion protagonists that was affected.
Well, he was eighth on the road at that time, so he was basically the eighth guy through all the debris, and he ends up being the unlucky one. So you have to feel for him a little bit there. Now, Mark Webber, going back to our Richmond analogy, he qualified third in a deluge on Saturday. Great qualifying lap by Mark. Unfortunately, a gearbox penalty pushes him back to eighth. He started eighth and finished eighth and just never really at the races at Hockenheim at all. 46 seconds off the win and a fair bit of head scratching going on in the number two car.
Yeah, really strange, to be honest. I mean, he was just nowhere. You know, on the pitches as well, he really didn't figure in any of the battles. He did a little bit early on, then seemed to struggle, you know, with the tyre. And there was obviously They were making analogies to wanting more camber, particularly on the McLaren, and some graining and things going on with the tyre. But I'm not sure what was wrong with Mark. Again, it's a track that he hasn't done well at. Whether it's just something that doesn't suit him. Clearly his car just wasn't on the pace, and it was a bit of a battle. I think he jagged one lap out of it. The gearbox penalty, I don't know. When someone's in the hunt for the World Drivers' Championship, it affects his championship when it's clearly a mechanical issue. So, it's a little bit frustrating.
Well, this is also a circuit where no one has won from lower on the grid than third since 2002. So, you really did need to be in those first couple of rows, which he was on merit, unfortunately got pushed back. So that's where we sit after 10 races. The Drivers' Championship, Fernando Alonso 154 in the lead. Mark Webber, luckily enough, after Hockenheim, didn't lose too many points relative to the pursuers. He's still in second on 120. Sebastian Vettel third, 110 points. Kimi Raikkonen fourth after a pretty solid run of results recently. Lewis Hamilton's DNF at Hockenheim, very costly. He's now 62 points behind Fernando Alonso in fifth place. Daniel Ricciardo, 2 points still from that ninth place finish in Melbourne. In the Constructors, Red Bull, 230 points lead the way. Ferrari on 177, just 23 of those for Felipe Massa, mind you. McLaren on 160, Lotus 159, very close for third. And while we're just talking Felipe Massa, we'll talk about this with Peter Windsor later on, but we've had some discussions off it. Do you see him in a red car next year?
Oh, maybe in a British touring car or a DTM car if it's red. No chance whatsoever. Look, I mean, I can't say that I'm privy to the inner workings of Ferrari, but if you just look at the results, his body language, after qualifying, walking down the pit lane, I can't see it. And I think if anything, it's detrimental to the long term pace of Ferrari.
Well, I think the interesting thing was last night, he was involved in an accident within about 3.5 seconds of the race starting when he ran straight up the back of Daniel Ricciardo into Turn 1.
Yeah, and an amateur mistake, really. I mean, at that level in Formula 1, the reflexes of the drivers to just clip the back there, he just pulled out of the toe. Well, it's really not a toe at that speed, but he just pulled out too late. Felipe hasn't been right since that big head injury.
Yep.
And, I don't think you ever forget how to drive. In my opinion, that doesn't happen. But there's something going on in the inner workings of the team, perhaps psychologically for him. As far as his preparation, I'm not sure, but it's just not working there. Time for a change for both parties, I would have thought.
I would think so, but after this short break, we'll ask Peter Windsor that exact question and a few others.
Don't forget to like the Australian Grand Prix on Facebook for behind-the-scenes news, updates and exclusive opportunities.
This is Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian GP.
It's been one of the most unpredictable Formula One seasons in recent memory, with 7 different winners in the first 10 races, which makes the form guide very hard to read. So to help us do that, we're joined by renowned writer and broadcaster, former Williams team manager and host of The Flying Lap, Peter Windsor. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, mate. Good to be there.
Now, I have to mention this, Peter, because you were one of the few people that picked Fernando Alonso to win the World Championship when he was missing out on Q3 in Melbourne by the thick end of a second and a half. What did you see in Ferrari in the early part of the season that made you think that way, and how have you assessed Fernando's season so far?
Well, I didn't actually see anything at Ferrari different from any other year. I just saw a Ferrari that is what it is. It's an incredibly impressive operation, always has been, always will be. Huge facilities, massive budget. And I think I think what made the difference this year is that it was very clear with the regulation changes they made last winter for this season that it was going to be a very close year. I mean, if you limit the scope of engine designers and aerodynamicists to the extent that they have now, inevitably, it's going to be close. You've got so many common parts on the cars now. And in that situation, I think one of the defining issues always is the way a team runs its drivers. And for me, I don't know whether they stumbled into it or what, but for me, Ferrari have the perfect balance because they have the genius of Fernando Alonso. And they have this guy, Felipe Massa, in the number two car, who has had a lot of flack and a lot of people give him a hard time. But for me, he's the perfect other driver for Ferrari because he's never going to annoy Fernando. He's going to let Fernando get on and run the team the way he wants it to be run around him. And every single point that Ferrari is capable of scoring will go to Fernando Alonso. And if you look at all the other teams, there was massive infighting definitely going to take place, as we can see, between Lewis and Jensen, between Mark and Seb, and indeed, you know, you could argue if the other runners are capable of winning between people like Michael and Nico. I mean, just to give you a good example, if Mark Webber had Felipe Massa in the other Red Bull, he'd be, what, I don't know, 6-7 points further up the road now in the World Championship? You could argue that's not a massive amount, but it could make the difference at the end of the season. So for me, Michael Schumacher taught the world how to win a driver's championship, as distinct from a constructor's championship, and that is you just focus all your points on one guy. And he won 5 world championships that way at Ferrari. And Ferrari have got exactly the same situation. So to me, put Fernando in there, it was always going to be difficult to beat him.
Pete, you mentioned Mark there, and let's put the Aussie cap on for a minute. He's re-signed for another year. Have you noticed anything that's kind of changed in his demeanour, you know, this year from, say, last year? Because he's certainly right back in that championship hunt again.
That's a good question, Cam. I think, for me, you know, when the car is not 100% capable of going out and dominating, that is a good time for Mark Webber against Sebastian Vettel, if you like. I think if the car is absolutely brilliant, it's very difficult for Mark to beat the Red Bull machine and everything that comes with Sebastian Vettel as a driver. But if they're struggling a bit with grip, traction, turning, whatever it is, I think that's when, you know, it's a cliche, but that's when Aussie grit can get into it and do a very good job. And I think most of the times in which he has done a better job than, well, he's been quicker than Sebastian over a weekend, it's usually when the car hasn't been right at the front. And I think that's another reason why Mark's having quite a good year, because it's a tough year and he's a tough racing driver and he gets on with it. And, you know, it's good to see. But as I said before, you know, if Red Bull have a championship-winning car, the guy Mark Webber has to beat in that championship-winning car is Sebastian Vettel in the championship-winning car, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do. It's the most difficult thing to do in all of motorsport. So it actually behoves Mark, in terms of his own individual success, for Red Bull not to be having the best car in Formula One, perversely.
So all that said, Peter, I mean, are we looking at a situation like 2010 again, where perhaps they could, you know, trip over one another? I mean, we saw so much acrimony between the two of them in 2010. Do you think that they've, the team and the two drivers, have learned from that, and we'll see a repeat of that coming up this year?
Well, I think, let's put it this way. If they get to Texas and Sebastian and Mark are 3 points apart from one another and they're running 1-2 in the World Championship, or 2-3, but only a few points away from Fernando, absolutely for sure there'll be major dramas, because Red Bull have no process in place to facilitate two drivers in that situation. They Christian Horner will say, well, you know, we want our drivers to race. We just told them not to run into one another, or whatever he says. But you can be sure there will be acrimony, for sure, because they don't have a structure. That will never happen at Ferrari, for the reasons I've just said, and that's the reason Fernando's in such strong shape. And to me, that intra-team rivalry business is always the most difficult thing to overcome if you're trying to win a driver's championship, if you are a fast racing driver. And it's the same with Lewis and Jensen. You know, it's no different. For the situation at McLaren is exactly the same as the situation at Red Bull. If those two guys are both in the running for the World Championship, there will be tears flying.
Pete, I just want to switch over to McLaren for a moment. Do you think the pace they showed at Hockenheim, you know, was genuine? And a second question there about McLaren, where are we at with Lewis Hamilton's negotiations?
Well, I think in answer to the first question, I think it was genuine. I mean, we know that is a quick car when they get it set up right. They seem to have more difficulty than most of the top teams in getting the tyre temperatures to work in the various variables that apply in Formula One, but that's always been the case at McLaren that I can remember, and certainly in the last, going back to the Mika Hakkinen days, really. I mean, they've always had an issue with tyre temperatures more than most teams. I don't know what it is, but they do. It's just the way they build their cars, and it's showing now. But there's no doubt that fundamentally that car is a very good car still, and, you know, Lewis or Jensen could win the Hungarian Grand Prix, no problem at all. It's good enough for that, and it is genuine pace, and you don't win races without having genuine pace in the car. I think I can't imagine where else Lewis would go or want to go. I mean, unless he's completely lost his mind, I can't imagine why he wouldn't want to stay at McLaren. It's a phenomenally good Formula One team. It's easy to work there. They've got a million people handling all the sponsorship and the marketing and the media. And, you know, the law of averages, if he hangs around at McLaren for another 4 or 5 years, he's going to win another couple of world championships, a bit like Fernando at Ferrari. So why on earth would he want to leave? I can't even think that he would enter his head, actually. And I can't imagine he wants any more money than he's got now, but I may be wrong there.
You can never have too much, Peter, apparently. But also wanted to talk to you a bit about Lotus. Obviously, the big headline there with Kimi Raikkonen coming back from a couple of years of driving rally cars and crashing them quite often as well. And he's obviously had a pretty consistent year. But what have you made of his performance relative to Romain Grosjean? Because I think a lot of people have been quite surprised by how accomplished Grosjean's been this year.
Well, one of the other things I did say at the start of the year was that if the Lotus is as good in 2012 as, say, the Braun was in 2009, Kimi will be the guy that will win with it and win the World Championship. But if the car isn't that and it's something less than that, then Kimi's always going to have problems with a guy like Romain Grosjean, because he's very reflexy, very, very fast, very brave, very able to sit a car on the ragged edge for quite a long time. I mean, it does show up in Q3. He does make quite a lot of mistakes in Q3 under pressure, but nonetheless, he's incredibly quick, and that was always going to be a problem for Kimi. And to me, Kimi, when he was at Ferrari, was about a tenth of a second a lap slower than he had been at McLaren, and I suspect that in his year off, or a couple of years off, he lost another tenth or so by, father time, whatever you want to call it. Mm. So he's now two tenths away from where he was at his peak at McLaren, and I think that's what we're seeing today. I think we're seeing a very good Kimi, we're seeing the McLaren Kimi, who's not quite as quick as he was. And if the car's very difficult to drive, he's going to back away from it a little bit rather than put it on the edge. And I think that's the difference. But he still brings a lot to the team in the sense that James Allison and the boys know that if that is the lap time, that is what that car is capable of doing. And that's a very important point for a lot of design engineers. I'm not sure that, right, the full length of the pit lane, every design engineer could say that is what our car is capable of. Sauber is a team that springs to mind there. Maybe that car is better than we actually see in terms of results.
Pete, Williams' victory in Barcelona was just fantastic for the sport, and I'm sure you will have enjoyed that one too. But what's happened to Maldonado since then?
Well, he's actually been quick on occasions, hasn't he? I mean, he was quickest on Friday, second session in Hockenheim. He qualified, for a Williams driver from where they were last year, he qualified really well at Hockenheim even. I think, Maldonado isn't the perfect racing driver by any means, but he's a lot better than people think. And, some of his shortcomings do show through under pressure in race situations, in putting a whole race together, in adapting his driving from one set of tyres to the next. His performance does seem to drop off after the first set of tyres or in the middle of the first stint. It's just a question of adaptation. But given where he started from and given where Williams were last year, I think he and the team are doing an outstanding job, actually. It's very difficult after a year like 2011 for a team like Williams to bounce back. But wow, they've done a great job in that. And Maldonado can do the lap. There's no question about that. And he can do the lap in a Kimi-like way, not in a Romain Grosjean-like way. And that's why he won the Spanish Grand Prix, because under pressure, he was on top of the car, he was manipulating it, he was getting nice little flat spots everywhere with it, and he wasn't in any way running any risk. And to me, he's been one of the revelations of the year, actually. It's very fashionable and people love to trash him, but to me, I think, give the guy credit. I think he's done an amazing job.
Yeah, well, you don't win by fluke, do you?
Absolutely.
No, exactly. And if you look at Perez, he had a golden opportunity to win the Malaysian Grand Prix, and a bit like Adam Scott yesterday, just managed to blow it in the last four holes, as it were, that was sad to see, because Sauber should have won that race.
I forgot to tell you that no one's talking about Adam Scott down here today. It didn't actually happen, but just shifting
well,
gears.
I'll tell you what, everyone's talking about South Africa over here, because we just had Ernie Els winning the British Open as a result of Adam Scott's demise, and Hashim Amla just hit 311 at the Oval, the highest test score ever hit in England. And I was watching him very closely as much as I could, and he was taking no fluids or food during play at all. That's 14 hours of batting because of Ramadan. That's one of the best exhibitions of self-control I've ever seen in my life. It was just
unbelievable.
Sorry, but I divert.
No, look, Peter, I'm so pleased. You have got your mandatory cricket reference out of the way, so I'm pleased with that. But just shifting gears for a second, the flying lap going strong. You're up to, I believe, episode 80 is next on the agenda for you. The show seems to be going from strength to strength.
Well, it's very sweet of you to say that, mate. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it is going well. It is episode 80. We're actually going to go into the August break and have a break this year. So we'll be back again at the end of August. But the show we're doing on Wednesday will be episode 80, and we'll be looking back at the German Grand Prix, But it is going well, yeah. You know, it's taking Formula One, I think, a long time to understand the internet and what it's all about. But our policy from day one has been a bit like yours. You know, the internet is there for the globe, and it's there for the world to enjoy. And, you know, we've got to start giving them good content, and that's what I try to do. And we're starting to get pretty good support from the teams. And, you know, our numbers are looking pretty good relative, I got to say, to most of the traditional magazines and so forth these days. You know, we're sort of four or five times bigger now.
Well, really good to hear, Peter. Look, we really thank you for your input for our mid-season review. Terrific to talk to you, and hopefully we'll talk to you on Keeping Track a little bit down the line.
Matty, look forward to it, and best of luck with your show as well. Great job.
Don't forget, you can follow the Australian Grand Prix on Twitter at Oz Grand Prix.
This is Keeping Track, the official podcast of the Australian GP.
Formula One drivers are said to be some of the fittest athletes on the planet. But what sort of shape do you need to be in to drive in Formula One? And how much work is done behind the scenes to keep a driver at his physical peak? To answer that question and many more, we're joined on the line by Daniel Ricciardo. Dan, welcome to the podcast again.
How are you? Good to be here, thank you.
Mate, compare your fitness and the work you do outside of the car now compared to, say, 1 year ago when this was all just kicking off for you as a full-time drive. What do you do differently now compared to them with the knowledge that you've picked up over the last 12 months?
I'd basically go from drinking a six-pack of lager to probably two six-packs. sorry, that's not the answer you're looking for, was it?
I don't think it's the right one either.
No, it's... No, not at all. No, like, yeah, you know, knowledge and everything's increasing about, you know, what's involved in driving these cars and what I need to do to be better at it. You know, fortunately, well, there's a upside and downside for now being full-time driver and traveling the world every week, more or less. Upside is driving the car is the best way to get fit for driving it. And I'm doing that more often than ever. But yeah, the downside is you struggle to actually spend time in the gym outside of the car. With all the travelling and other commitments, you know, I'm probably training less than I have in a long time. But then again, I'm actually probably as fit in the car as I have been for a while. So yeah, basically driving is the best way, but you know, in the gym, say, you know, if I've got a good week at home in England, you know, out of 7 days, we'll be in the gym six of those, morning, afternoon, and just, you know, get your cardio well. So sit on a bike or do some cross training between a bike, a treadmill, and rowing machine, you know, say an hour or so to last the race, the distance of the race, obviously, so to get good cardiovascular fitness. And then maybe the afternoon we'll build up some core, some neck, and just some general resistance, you know, with some weights and stuff. But you know, not too heavy. We can't really bulk up or put on too much mass. So it's more resistance and just, you know, general strength.
Is there a limit to how much you can do? I mean, obviously in the off-season you can stockpile a bit of fitness, but you mentioned the travel and the time zones and that sort of thing. That would make it very difficult for you to do anything really on the road. So did you have a very big off-season between 2011 and 2012 to try and compensate for that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's you know, normally the most important time of the year because, yeah, you know, knowing what is ahead and knowing that you're not going to really be able to get many solid weeks of training through the year, January is the best time to crunch, you know, crunch down on that. December's my, you know, my time off. It's really the only month I'm back home. So, you know, that's sort of dedicated to spending it with mates and letting loose a bit. But as soon as January comes, then it's a good, solid, you know, month of, you know, six-day-a-week training. And that's when you can really find your gains. And then you just try to, you know, keep it for the first part of the year. And then, you know, maybe in the summer break or the European summer, you can, you know, get another few weeks of training, build it up again, and then try to keep it for the second half of the year. But yeah, you know, through the season, it really is just maintenance. And, you know, sometimes the best training is sleep, just to make sure we recover and not get run down and sick. So yeah, it's finding that balance has been, you know, a bit of an experience and something new for me. You know, previous years I haven't put up with all the travelling, and you know, it's been sort of, if I had a day off, I'd push hard and train and try and be a Spartan. But some days I got to be a little bit sensible and in a way be a little bit lazy and just relax and try and recover.
You mentioned the physical side to the training. I was reading a piece recently with Dr. Riccardo Ceccarelli. I know he does some work with Toro Rosso, and he seems to indicate that the drivers need to spend maybe 30% of their time doing physical training and the rest of it really on mental training. Tell us about some of the aspects of that side of it, because that's an underappreciated part of your training, I'm sure, for a lot of the fans out there.
Yeah, it's I think it varies between a lot of drivers. I mean, I think some drivers have like a mental sort of coach, and others, you know, don't really do anything on it. When I was younger, I did a bit more on it. I think, you know, when I moved to Europe and stuff, tried to, you know, clear my head in a way and go through a bit of visualization things. But now it's more for me. It's more active stuff. So, you know, before I get in the car, maybe I'll just try and switch on, you know, do some like tennis ball stuff and get my coordination going. You know, maybe I'll sit down and visualize a lap of the track, you know, and try and drive it in my head and maybe time it and make sure I'm getting, you know, the same lap time as I would out on the track. But yeah, it's something I haven't honestly gone into too much detail with the mental side. For me, it's more just trying to get into my zone and just chill out and, you know, maybe get a bit of a massage or a stretch before I get in the car and just listen to a bit of music.
Now, your trainer at the moment is a guy by the name of Paul Haynes, who was at the Geelong AFL team when it was going through a recent run of success. We won't ask him about his AFL team, but tell us how you came to work with Paul and what have you learned from him in the time that you spent together so far?
Yeah, so it all came about. Paul moved to Europe last year, and then he got employed by the company that was put in charge of training us Red Bull youngsters. So my trainer from last year moved elsewhere in the company. He decided to go on to another role, and then that left me with you know, a new guy to help me out, and Paul just came on, and unfortunately he was the guy. he's standing next to me, and it was cool. So it was all put through, I guess, the system, and it's not like I knew him from, you know, a few years ago and said I want him, to be honest, but it was more, this was the situation. Obviously, I did some, you know, sessions with him, and, you know, obviously, if I wasn't comfortable, I wouldn't go through with someone who I wasn't. But it all went pretty well, and I think we're doing all right this year.
A trainer tends to sort of be a right-hand man to the drivers in many ways. Have you got him out there on the pit wall, holding out the pit board at this stage, or is he not graduated to that just yet?
Yeah, he is, mate. He is. It's he's out on the pit board, and I guess, yeah, a lot of the time, you know, on a race weekend, sometimes, I mean, I don't really see him that much because it's, you know, I've got so many meetings with the engineers and that. He's just there, you know, when I'm in the car, you know, making sure I got my hydration and keeping me cool with some air if I need it. So he's like my little, I won't say the word on the podcast, but you probably know what word
I know where you're going.
But no, not in a bad way at all. But no, he is sort of a right-hand man, I guess. But then I guess all our work, well, most of our work is done, you know, away from the circuit. And but yeah, he does keep an eye on, you know, my nutrition at the circuit and making sure I'm getting enough hours of sleep, you know, not watching movies till midnight, etc. So he's pretty disciplined with me, and I think it's important. You definitely need someone who keeps you in mind.
You mentioned the hydration and the food side of things. Give us some sort of indication as to, you know, even how much liquid you're having to take on, because obviously when you do a race like a Malaysia or a Singapore, you're losing an incredible amount of body weight just through perspiration. And that's obviously part of Paul's job too, to make sure that you're fed and hydrated properly. Give us an idea as to your fluid intake and what you might eat over the course of a race weekend to stay in peak condition.
Yeah, it's probably the biggest part of what we do over the weekend is monitoring how much we drink, and you know, we sort of in a way base it off also, you know, what colour it is when we go to the toilet. It's a good sign of knowing how well hydrated we are. But yeah, you know, through the day I'll drink sort of, I don't know, I'd say between three and probably 4 litres. At the very hot races, definitely you'll get around 4 litres, and it's mixed, you know, with water and also you know, your isotonic drinks and all that sort of stuff, with your mineral salts and all the goodies, because yeah, like the hot races we can lose. I mean, Singapore last year, I think I lost 2.5 kilos in the 2-hour race. So I'll definitely recommend Formula One to someone who's on a weight loss program. It's a pretty quick way to lose weight. So, yeah, mate, so I'd say we're probably drinking around 3 litres a day. And then nutrition is, you know, at lunch, because there's not a big turnaround between the practice sessions, we can't have a huge lunch. Mm. But, you know, maybe like a small bowl of pasta, just with some chicken and some salad. Mm. And then dinner, maybe we can stock up a bit more, have, you know, a steak and some rice and veggies, something along those lines. But always snacking as well during the day, just to keep the energy up and, you know, keep your calorie intake going.
Of course, the nutrition side of things extends to when you're back home as well. How are those cooking skills coming along, mate? What's your what's the signature dish at the moment?
Mate, I haven't been at home to cook. I think I worked out in May. I was home for 3 days out of the whole month, something like this. It was silly, but I don't know, what can I cook? Not much. bowl of pasta, some toast, cereal. No, mate, I'm fortunately for me, I've normally got company, and you know, we'll maybe get together with someone else and cook up something. But I'm not really that great. But yeah, fish is easy. Sometimes you can just, you know, put some fish on, or you know, steak, you can always just throw on the hot plate, so it's not too bad. It's good enough to eat, but I wouldn't say I go to much effort with putting gourmet, you know, things on the side of the plate.
Well, mate, food skills notwithstanding, all very interesting, and thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us on the podcast. We'll catch you down the line soon.
All right, no worries, Matt. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Before we wrap up, just a reminder that tickets are now on sale for the 2013 Formula One Australian Grand Prix from March 14 to 17 at Albert Park. Make sure you don't miss the chance to book early and get the best seat in the house to see Mark Webber and Daniel Ricciardo on the grid for their home Grand Prix. Go to grandprix.com.au or call Foxtix on 1800 100 030 to find out more. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Keeping Track. Don't forget to like the Australian Grand Prix on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Oz Grand Prix, and go to grandprix.com.au, where you'll find details of which big-name international guests are coming up on our next episode. Thanks to our guests Peter Windsor and Daniel Ricciardo, and thank you for listening, and join us again on Keeping Track soon.